On Saturday, the New York Times published a story titled A Voice of Hate in America's Heartland. It was a profile of Tony Hovater, a 29-year-old Ohio welder who would be rightfully described as nondescript if he weren't a hate-spewing white nationalist. The piece by Richard Fawcett aimed not to unmask a scoundrel, but to muse on the, at least superficially unremarkable lifestyle, of the Nazi next door. I found the story terrifying. Many others felt it was a disgrace on the grounds of normalizing and even glorifying hate. The outcry provoked a reaction from the Times, which offered regret about hurt feelings, but defended the journalism. Although, as Fawcett himself confessed in an accompanying first-person piece to his profile, it offered no insight into how Hovater became what he became. Among the critics was BuzzFeed's Charlie Worzel, who thinks the Times piece failed to adequately contextualize the ravings of an avowed Nazi. Charlie, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
So the Times puts out this feature by Richard Fawcett on the Nazi next door, Tony Hovater. And in about 10 seconds, Twitter blows up with outrage. Before we discuss the merits of Fawcett's journalism and your follow-up, why the freakout?
I think that there's a real sensitivity right now towards the coverage of and the attention, the amount of attention focused on far-right extremists. I think a lot of people feel that there is a disproportionate amount of coverage that doesn't interrogate them or label them properly or have enough outrage about them. There seems to be a desire on sort of behalf of the media policeman of Twitter when you write about a far-right extremist or a neo-Nazi to express outrage in every sentence or every paragraph or, you know, to make sure in all caps to say, this is not normal.
Well, let's talk about error, if there was any. You certainly felt that Fawcett's reporting was lacking in at least one major area.
Yeah, the thing that struck me, not just reading the piece, but also reading the follow-up that Fawcett wrote himself about the behind the scenes of the story, was that he set out to answer a question that's pretty admirable, which is how does a seemingly normal young man without any traumatic background become a Nazi sympathizer and white nationalist? And if you're trying to answer that question, one of the biggest components here is the internet and the ecosystem that allows a lot of hateful ideology to spread. And that was lacking in the piece, I noticed.
Well, it was there. I mean, there were three or four specific mentions of his exposure to 4chan. It wasn't the focus of the piece, but it was certainly incorporated. But you think it got short shrift?
I do. I think that the overwhelming context for the rise of far-right politics and white nationalist sentiment and the alt-right in general has to do with the rise of forums and areas where off-color jokes about something like the Holocaust become normalized to an extent and communities sort of form around that ideology. And as I have reported for the past 18 months, talking with people, they say that, you know, it really is a place where you can be radicalized and, you know, where you can find the syllabus to read more about these ideas and you find a supportive community. And I think when we're talking about, you know, how a white nationalism rises up and how you can get to a point where people are marching in Charlottesville carrying tiki torches, I think the internet is a huge part of that story.
I wondered whether this guy, for all his sort of normal middle-class behaviors and environment, is a two-headed goat who is particular unto himself and one of a handful of people like him, or whether he's much closer to the one-third of the electorate that supports Donald Trump no matter what, and as a constitute, presents a grave threat to everything that we cherish in American democracy and human rights and the rest. Is he the man who bites the dog, or is he just one of many, many, many dogs who bite men?
So I interviewed him myself over Facebook Messenger after the story came out because I had some questions about how the internet has played in his politics. And I kind of ran up against some of the same issues that the reporter from the New York Times talks about, which is that he wasn't very forthcoming about a lot of issues. If you go and look at his internet presence, he's sharing memes from places that like 4chan or Reddit's subreddit, the Donald, which traffics in a lot of conspiratorial and meme content. And yet he says that the internet doesn't really play any role. So you're seeing these sort of two sides. He seemed very resistant to the idea of being stereotyped in any way as a, you know, a Gamergate style person. He said multiple times, I'm not a gamer. I respect women. And that may be true, but then many of the things that he was sharing, one post that he shared after Charlottesville sort of mocked the counter-protester who died in Charlottesville. I think it's really difficult to know as a sort of random reporter who jumps into this person's life, especially people who have, you know, so much to lose by speaking to the press, whether or not they're being forthcoming, which is sort of why the additional context of his online life felt so important to me.
You know, everyone in journalism constantly faces the question, well, why didn't you write about so-and-so instead of writing about that? And the answer almost always is because we weren't writing about so-and-so. We were writing about something else. In this case, this guy's kind of middle-brow banality of evil. And is asking for something different, like criticizing a car for being a bad bicycle?
I think, and I wrote in my piece, that there's a lot of journalistic merit and value in describing the banality of hate and showing how it is normalized out in the world. And I think the Times had the right instinct in doing that. I think, though, that when you're covering these movements, it's really important to have the kind of context, I think, showing how this movement has jumped off of the internet and into the real world more sort of shows how you have a community in Ohio that seems to either ignore or tolerate this individual. You have an employer, he's a welder, as the Times says, that either ignores or tolerates his beliefs. As somebody told me, you know, the internet is sort of the vascular system that allows this ideology to move the way it does.
How in the world are we supposed to deal with hate mongers? Do we, as some people would wish, just starve them of oxygen, you know, and let them sort of suffocate due to lack of attention? Do we debunk their every idiotic, hateful utterance with the facts and expressions of indignation? Or, you know, do we do what this guy did, which is just to show the mundane reality of it and scare the living bejesus out of all of us, not because what he says should be accepted, but because it is normal to a degree that is truly terrifying. This piece really frightened me, and it didn't need all caps to do so.
I think that we're in the middle of figuring out as a press how to do this. And I think that there are great examples. My colleague at BuzzFeed, Joe Bernstein, published an expose earlier this fall on Breitbart and its ties to white nationalism that had access to, you know, emails. So there's that element of exposing things that these people with these ideologies don't want to be seen. That's obviously always a great way to cover this. I am of the mind, partially due to my beat, that sunlight is the best sort of disinfectant for this, that you can't hide from these sorts of ideologies, nor should you. And interviewing and interrogating these people is always a better tactic. There's been a lot of people saying, why doesn't the New York Times have a white nationalist beat reporter? They have an ISIS beat reporter. And I think that those sorts of things are really valuable lessons to learn from this. You know, perhaps there are, I don't want to go so far as to say only a certain group of people should write about this, but, you know, having expertise in this subject, which is becoming more and more important and is sort of wrapped up in all this anxiety about how it's covered, I think it's important to look at specificity and highlighting work from people who live in this world, essentially.
Some of the reaction was reaction to the Times reaction to the reaction. what did you think of the editor's note and of Fawcett's reply as a reaction to the uproar?
The only reaction that people want to hear and the right reaction to this is to say, we understand how critically important it is to get this right, and we understand how much interest there is in this subject, and we are going to deploy our reporting resources towards that. I do think, given, you know, the amount of responses from the Times, from the editors, from the reporters, you know, that they're taking this to heart. And I think that, you know, there's so much great journalism that comes out of there. And I'm hopeful that they'll pursue this subject with the rigor and thoughtfulness that we know them for.
Charlie, thanks.
Thank you.
Charlie Worzel is a senior writer for BuzzFeed. Thanks for listening to this OTM podcast extra. To further satisfy your OTM Jones, sign up for our weekly newsletter at onthemedia.org. You can also check out our Facebook page, which is simply stuffed with unexpected delights. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Garfield.